Chapter 21. Mars and Chenevert found the emerging evanescent flow shoal right where it should have been, doing what Mars had hypothesized it would be doing, expanding and moving, and more than that, throwing off even more flow shoals that whipped out and forward and then evaporated in minutes or seconds. Mars hadn't been expecting that, and it didn't quite fit his model, and he knew that he could spend an entire career digging into just that one aspect of the emergent evanescent flow shoals and would never run out of things to say about it. Mars Claremont's life was a ridiculously full festival of data. Enough so that it fell to Chenevert to remind him that while all the data they were gathering was glorious, they had a task and focus, and maybe they should work on that. So Mars grudgingly set aside anything that was not related to gauging the baseline resonance of the flow medium and mapping the continuing effects of the now ancient cavitation to see how the remaining data related to his hypothesized values of each. These two were intriguingly different, close but different, and Mars, as a scientist, appreciated how even small variations would mean vast changes would propagate down the line, vastly changing the predictions for the appearance and duration of evanescent flow streams, both in the near future and in decades and even centuries to come. It also reinforced Mars's belief that the next step was to get more readings from emergent evanescent flow shoals and their attendant streams. Incremental refining of hypotheses with new, pertinent data was not sexy, but it was important. It also suggested, just suggested, but even so, that there might even be a way to do the thing they wanted, to shape the flow shoals and move them and even perhaps get them to swallow human habitats whole. Which would open up a whole raft of second-order problems that Mars wasn't sure he wanted to confront, including the question of how to shape a time-space bubble of such volume that it could include a kilometers-long habitat inside of it. But he also realized that he didn't have to solve every problem. If he solved this problem, other people could handle the rest. And solving this problem was enough for anyone. Mars was so wrapped up in his own world of data and hypotheses that he almost forgot to send a note to Cardinia to initiate their evening chat of short bursts of text punctuated by long pauses. This night, Mars simply put, "So much data. Love you," as his text, hoping that Cardinia would understand he was too distracted by shiny science to be a useful conversationalist to her tonight. Cardinia responded simply, "Love you too," and in those words, he could imagine her smiling at his guileless enthusiasm for science. He was glad she did. And could, for the umpteenth time since the night before he and Chenevert departed to observe this emerging flow shoal, Mars took a second to be amazed, simply and profoundly amazed, that Cardinia had proposed marriage to him. It had been, Mars knew, an impulsive decision on her part, and perhaps even a rash one. Cardinia had long before filled him in on how she had been intended to marry the ill-fated Ahmet Nohama-Peton, and how someone in her position was not always or even often afforded the luxury of marrying for love. That was for people who didn't have so much power that they literally couldn't give it away, the sort of power Cardinia had as Emperor. She had told him this with such plaintive matter-of-factness that Mars had been surprised when he felt something akin to pity for her, the most powerful person among the billions in the interdependency. Mars had already known this about her, even before she told him, and had always kept some part of himself in reserve. Not his heart, because he knew he loved Cardinia, and there was no point in deluding himself about that. But the quiet, logical parts in his head that made him aware that this relationship would end one day, if he was lucky by the simple entropy of overfamiliar people falling out of love with each other, but by some other, more heart-wrenching process, if not. And when it happened, when, not if, he would have to be able to have the grace to accept it and to know that love was never part of an emperor's inheritance. And yet Cardinia had proposed anyway, to him, and despite his initial fumble of it, he had accepted. With that, Mars was done holding back the quiet and logical parts in his head. Mars and Cardinia might perhaps one day mess up their relationship. People did that, and Mars didn't delude himself that just because he loved Cardinia, it didn't mean he wouldn't aggravate the crap out of her sometimes. But they would do it from a state that would encourage constancy and reconciliation as a baseline. Mars was pretty sure he could work with that. Every day, a new day to start again, building a life together. Hours later, when at last Mars couldn't keep the streams of data clear in his vision or his head, he headed to his stateroom on the Auvergne and put his head on his pillow and thought muzzy and contented thoughts of Cardinia as he was swiftly pulled into a full and dreamless sleep. As he surfaced out from that sleep almost 12 hours later, he thought he heard Cardinia say, simply, "Mars," just as he opened his eyes. Mars Claremont pulled himself up from his bed, yawned and stretched, put on clothes, and then walked to the bridge of the Auvergne, where Thomas Chenevert, who had initially let Mars sleep as late as he possibly could, was waiting for him to tell him that Cardinia, the Emperor Greyland II, was dead. The voyage back to Xi'an took 8 days and 1,000 years. The Xi'an that Mars returned to was not the one he had left. His formal position on the imperial staff was as a special advisor for science to the Emperor, which was an appointment personal to the Emperor herself. When Greyland died, all her personal appointments, advisors, assistants, and consultants were suspended, pending the pleasure of the incoming Emperor, who historically would be bringing in their own staff and therefore would have little need of the former Emperor's staff. For Mars, this meant that every project or initiative that he had undertaken on behalf of Greyland, which meant all of them, was halted, held up pending review by the incoming Emperor. Mars was no longer able to access files or data on the Imperial servers or to share the new data he had collected with other scientists until such time as the new Emperor or their appointed representatives for the Emperor's personal science and research initiatives allowed him to do so. In itself, this presented little problem for Mars. He had always kept copies of his work on his own devices, and all the work had been shared with Chenevert anyway. He could get the information to others if he chose, and work on it himself in the meanwhile. But being officially closed off from his work, and what that act represented with respect to his relationship with the Imperial apparatus, unmoored him. Speaking of being unmoored, the Auvergne was now no longer permitted to berth at the Emperor's private space dock at Xi'an. Mars, whose ship it was assumed to be, had to make arrangements elsewhere at the habitat, paying the exorbitant fee for a temporary berthing out of the vault of marks that he had carried with him from End. The berthing would indeed have to be temporary because its costs would quickly whittle down Mars's stash of money. Thus, Mars was reminded that there was a difference between being merely rich, as he was, and profoundly rich, which he was going to have to be to keep a ship the size of the Auvergne parked anywhere in the system. Pending the disposition of his employment with the new Emperor, Mars was permitted to stay in his palace quarters, the bachelor studio that he had only rarely slept in the last several months. Mars had not been allowed to retrieve his things from the Emperor's apartments. His effects, clothes, toiletries, a few other personal items, had been delivered to his palace quarters before he and the Auvergne had even returned to Xi'an. Mars had been shut out of the personal aspects of the Imperial world as effectively and efficiently as he had been shut out of its professional aspects. Of course, everyone knew that Mars and Greyland had had a close friendship, as the euphemism went. Back in his bachelor quarters, Mars had received kindness and sympathy from other members of the Imperial staff, some of whom found themselves, like Mars, waiting to hear if their positions would be retained. What they, nor anyone else, understood was the quality of that close friendship. That it had not been a close friendship at all, but actual love, genuine and true. Mars understood that others in the Imperial household could not be faulted for thinking that he had been nothing more than a fond plaything for a powerful person. He had never chosen to capitalize or brag about the relationship. It wasn't anyone else's business. But that unwillingness to speak casually about what he shared with Greyland, with Cardinia, meant that in the eyes of everyone else, except those very few who knew the Emperor the best, Mars had no special claim to the Emperor or her person. No one else knew that Cardinia had proposed to him. Mars was widowed in all the ways one could be, without the benefit of a single soul to understand his pain and bereavement. He hadn't even told Chenevert. He felt it wasn't his place to share that information first. When one's fiancée was the Emperor, you let her make the announcements. He could tell Chenevert now, clearly. He could tell anyone who would choose to listen. But he would not, because Cardinia wasn't there to offer her side of it. Mars knew with certainty what would be thought of him if he declared the engagement here and now. That was fine with Mars. He didn't need anyone else to know Cardinia had asked him to marry her. He knew, and he would carry it with him forever. Mars did not stay in his bachelor quarters and did not wait to discover the disposition of his role in the imperial household. Mars had come to Hub to deliver the news his father had asked him to, the news about the collapse of the flow. He had stayed because the Emperor, because Cardinia, had asked him to stay. She was gone, and his responsibilities, to her and to his father, had been fulfilled. Besides, the new Emperor was going to be Nadashe Nohama Peten. Mars resigned his position, cleaned out his quarters, and moved into the Auvergne. Both because Chenevert had invited him to, and because, as Mars figured it, he was already paying rent in the form of the appallingly high docking fee. "What is your plan now?" Chenevert asked him after he had moved in. "I don't know," Mars said. "My original plan was to go back to End. That's difficult now because the Nohama Petans have the planet blockaded. Greyland had a plan to send an armada. That's been canceled, obviously. Nadashe is the incoming Emperor. She's not going to move against her own brother. We could still slip in through that back door," Chenevert said. "It's still open, if we hurry." "We?" "I have no ties here, clearly. And we're friends." "Thank you," Mars said, genuinely touched. "But I couldn't ask you to risk that. Even if no one's watching that one flow shoal, that doesn't mean we won't be spotted approaching the planet. The Auvergne is not small." "You underestimate my stealth," Chenevert said. "I'd rather underestimate your stealth than underestimate their ability to destroy you as an unidentified craft." "Fair enough. No, I can't go back to End. Not yet. Maybe not ever." "Then I return to my original question," Chenevert said. "I return to my original answer," Mars replied. "I don't know. Not yet. I'll figure it out soon. If nothing else, you and I have a lot of data left to work through. Maybe we'll find answers in it." He smiled and looked over to the apparition of Chenevert. "We're still the interdependency's last hope, after all. We could keep working on that, whether the incoming Emperor wants us to or not."
"I like that idea. It appeals to the futile romantic in me."
"I'm sorry you've been dragged into all of this," Mars said. "When we found you, you were sleeping comfortably. We woke you up, put you in the middle of a space battle, and when you came here, I got you involved in the same sort of political machinations that you had fled from. I wouldn't blame you if you purged me into space while I was sleeping."
"I assure you, I have no plans to purge you," Chenevert said. "My dear Lord Mars, I am very fond of you. Yes, I was sleeping quite contentedly when you found me. It's possible I could have slept until my power ran down and I drifted away into a quiet death. But I don't regret you waking me. You have offered me a better life and a better purpose than I have had in years, and perhaps ever. And if our task fails and our effort is ultimately futile, it was still worth the fight. I will be forever grateful that I was able to fight this with you and with your Emperor. Thank you."
"You're welcome," Mars said. He got up to head for his stateroom.
"Gardenia was a remarkable person," Chenevert said to him as he left. "You were right to love her, Mars."
"Thank you."
"And she was right to love you."
Mars had nothing to say to that. He nodded and left. In his stateroom, Mars prepared for bed, and in doing so, ran his eyes over the small collection of possessions he had to his name. One of them caught his eye, and he picked it up. It was the pocket watch, the first gift that Cardinia had ever given him. He opened it, and his eyes fell on the Chinese markings, the inscription that Cardinia had put there. "This is our time." "It was our time," Mars said to Cardinia, who was not there. "And it was worth it. I just wish there had been more of it." Mars willed himself to sleep. Just before it came, he imagined he heard Cardinia saying his name. It comforted him, and he gave himself over to it and slept.